Thanks for tuning in to Unscripted, presented by Be Unique magazine, because an authentic life is unscripted. Be Unique is a 501c3 charity that works today to change tomorrow. Learn more at our website, beunique.org. That's BUNEKE.org. Did you know that Be Unique is a free, nonprofit publication? We work today to change tomorrow by bringing you truly amazing guests like the one we'll introduce tonight, and by highlighting stories about people all over the world who will astound you. The free digital version is available 24/7 at beunique.org. That's BUNEKE.org.
Welcome, everybody, to Be Unique Unscripted. I'm your host, Mary Brotherton, and today I'm here with Christopher Keevil. He's an ordained Zen priest and senior Dharma teacher at the Single Flower. So I forgot how to ask you how to pronounce this.
Sangha.
Sangha, just like it looks. Christopher has been practicing Zen since 1991 and teaching since 1998 in the lineage of his teacher, Zen Master Bo Moon, also known as George Bowman, who is a Dharma heir of the Korean Zen Master Sun San. How are you doing, Christopher? And welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. And it's really great to meet you. I appreciate your offering me to be on.
Now, you're also the managing director and founder of Wellspring Consulting, right?
Wellspring, that's right. And we serve nonprofit organizations all over the country and
Excellent.
Help them with planning and strategy. And yeah, it's been a wonderful, wonderful venture.
I should have contacted you before 2018 when we started Be Unique.
Yeah, I saw that you started up and I was reading about the annual report for Be Unique. It was really inspiring.
And we're still working on this year's annual report. We've had a few obstacles stand in our way. They're good obstacles. We've been so busy and so, in fact, you may know from when we were booking you on this show, we're currently booking guests as far as 2022 for this show.
Wow.
So it's a good problem to have.
It is. That's great.
And we've been working with interns. I'm manifesting that two or three of them at least will hang on as volunteers after their internship.
That's great. Yeah.
We take it one step at a time.
That's great. Well, it all runs on inspiration, doesn't it?
Yes.
Huh?
That's the way the world should run.
Yeah.
Now, you've recently written a biographical book called Finding Zen in the Ordinary.
Mm-hmm. It's a book that kind of emerged over a number of years, and I felt it would be wonderful to share some of the insights that had come to me over my whole life. There's things in there from different points of time, which seem to be spiritual insights or things that really brought me to greater points of clarity.
I love the cover.
Good.
That's so ordinary.
I hold it up here.
cover
with the sesame bun on it.
Yes, I think that's very cool. Uh-huh. So what was your inspiration to write this?
Well, I have been working for a number of years with a Zen teacher, as you mentioned. And about 10 years ago, we started with weekly phone calls on koan study, which is a study using formal Zen stories to really elucidate dialogue and insight together, and really is a form of teaching where the Zen teacher will work with a student. And in this case, working as a student with a Zen teacher, I found it to be really enlightening and meaningful. And I found myself doing writing as a result, writing down my experiences in the interactions, writing my memories of particular things that had arisen. I wrote something like 400 pages, and I thought, I actually think this could turn into a book, but this is not it. This is just sort of a recording of all sorts of interactions and thoughts and so forth. So I then spent another 5 or 6 years boiling it down and simplifying to what's now, I think, a very short set of expressions, but hopefully relatively deep and pithy that can be inspiring to people.
I like that. Deep and pithy.
That's my hope.
So What led you on this path? Why did you decide I need to find the Zen in the ordinary?
Well, I have struggled in my life, as many of us have, just with the challenges of daily living, the disappointments when trying to serve a client, or the process of being married and working with a spouse to make a good life, or raising children, or dealing with physical issues, sprained ankle, or all the things that come up, a sort of a regular stream of challenges. And I think I really felt that life was pretty hard, and it really seemed that I ought to figure out a way to deal with that. So I occurred to me that I should perhaps go more deeply into a spiritual practice. And if I was going to learn tennis or how to play a musical instrument, I would find a teacher. But perhaps it would be good to find someone I could learn a spiritual practice from. And it seemed from the spiritual traditions I'd heard about that there was something to an alleviation of suffering or dealing with one's challenges in ways. And I thought maybe there's something here for me. And so I started reading and went to a few meditation gatherings and tried to figure out how I might proceed. And then it was in 1991, I was at a talk given by the man I now work with as a teacher. And it was at the beginning of the first Gulf War. There was an announcement that the bombing of Baghdad had just started while we were there in meditation. And I felt this very deep concern that I didn't really know the politics or the diplomacy of it, but I was aware that my tax dollars were helping to destroy buildings and harm people and create this actually vast destruction. And I felt it in my heart as a great sense of responsibility. And I was moved because the fellow who got up and spoke that evening said, "My heart is in my mouth. I don't feel that I can speak, but rather I'd like to lead us in chanting, chanting to the spirit of compassion." And so that's what we did that evening. And I really felt that he was responding from a genuine feeling about the nature of what was going on that evening. And it drew me to him as somebody who felt genuine and present, and really started my relationship with him as a teacher. So it's been over many years, nearly 30 years now. And I think in more recent years, the sense of the strength of the Zen practice and its meaning for me has grown, which kind of led to the expression of it within a book. And I hope to share it with others as well.
I like that story. And it reminds me of something that happened to me just last night. I have a practice of reciting the things for which I'm grateful as I go to sleep at night.
Yeah, wonderful.
But last night was different. I sat down, I started with the basics, my house, my warmth and comfort food on the table. And then all of a sudden I heard a voice say, "I already know how you're grateful. I know all the things that I've given you. Could you just be with me?" So I'm like, oh my gosh. Now I hear these voices constantly, so it's not a new thing for me. But it was different because the voice was making a request instead of just giving some advice. Usually I get advice that way. But this one was weird because I immediately, being the kind of thinker that I am, thought, how do I do this? I need to do it right. I have to do it perfect. How do I be with this entity and not make a mistake? And I thank goodness God knows I'm his clown, because he just laughed at me and said, "I don't need you to do it right. I just need you to do it." And before I remember what happened, I was awake this morning. I had fallen into a deep, deep sleep. And you talk about Zen. That was about as Zen as it comes. And your story about this teacher saying, "I want to talk, but I can't. I just need to chant. I just need to be here."
Right.
That's basically what he was saying, wasn't it? I just need to be.
Yeah, very much.
And so I need to be with all of you.
Be all together. Yes. Right. In this moment.
Yeah. That is so cool. Yeah. Your stories, you mentioned that they're deep and pithy, and they are, because I've read the PDF.
Good. Yeah.
I think the one that really speaks to me is about the subway.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That it was just so one human to another human, reaching out in kindness and telling a disturbed person, "You're going to be okay."
Right.
And there's so much. I think a lot of people think, "Oh, Zen, he's a Zen priest. That means he's better than me, or he's different from me." Mm-hmm. But I think the practice of Zen means just being all of us the same and equal and one. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, very much so. When I started really engaging in a serious Zen practice, I really hoped and thought that there was a way of getting to some higher plane, to really really kind of address the challenges in my life and feel wonderful most all the time. And in working with the teacher I was working with, he said, you know, I've worked with many and lived with many spiritual teachers, and everyone struggles. We all have our challenges. There's no place you can go where you're not dealing with this human life and with the regular disappointments and challenges.
That's the key.
Yeah.
We're here experiencing a human existence.
Yes.
Even though we know that we are spiritual beings. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we wouldn't have this angst within us.
Yeah.
If we were just physical creatures, I shouldn't say I don't know for a fact. Like, because I think my cat suffers a little bit of angst at times, and dogs suffer anxiety, separation from their,
sure,
their,
yeah,
people, but they don't seem to agonize like humans do over, yeah, some of the basic things that we really don't need to agonize over.
Yeah, I know.
Well, and see a dog, mm-hmm, meeting another dog for the first time, mm-hmm, it's most of the time, if they're well-adjusted dogs, they meet on an equal plane.
Yeah.
You know, hey, you're a dog, I'm a dog, let me sniff you, you sniff me, let's talk a little bit, let's wag our tails. And I think if more people could be more like dogs and other animals, it might be a little easier to live in this physical world.
Yeah. Well, I have come to find, at least through my own life and practice, that it's not about getting to a better place, but it's about becoming really genuine with the place that I keep being in at different times. I get to a really happy stage in my life, and I think to myself, wonderful, I've finally gotten there. And it's quicker than I expect to be feeling really rotten.
Then
it's quicker than I expect to be feeling, you know, something else again, excited. And it's just remarkable how it keeps revolving and revolving. Our minds don't seem to think that that's going to happen. It's like, oh, everything's terrible, it's always going to be this way. But developing some sort of space around all of that and recognizing that I am not my own challenges or my own excitement, and that arises and falls away, can make it much more easy to engage and really put myself out forward as genuinely as I can. And in a way, it's not about, in my mind, becoming happier, but it's about becoming more present and more genuine. And through that, really owning one's own life. We have a short time on this earth, and I don't want to get to the end of it and say, oh, it went by so fast, I missed it. But rather say, I was deeply involved in my own life.
Right.
And I did my very best, and I engaged a lot of the time I was wholly there. And then I think I get my life. I have my life by being in that space.
And I think that's the key, is knowing that our life is finite.
Very much so. It is.
And we have to grasp it with all we're worth. And that doesn't mean go out and make rash decisions or do things foolishly,
right,
but more mindfully.
Right.
And I think if we can, like you said, you know, one moment you're happy and then the next moment something happens and you're not as happy, then you accept that as part of the life process. And I have found, for me, the quicker I can process something and say, oh, this isn't working for me.
Uh-huh.
And I can move beyond what is working for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a hard concept when I first started learning to meditate.
Oh, yeah.
I found, you know, especially if I was using a guide, whether it was a physical person or a video or something like that, they'd say, just process, you know, acknowledge any discomfort and move on. I'm like, how do I do that?
Yeah.
Appraise your body and know where you're comfortable. And if you have if your back's hurting or your foot's hurting or whatever, just acknowledge it and move on. I'm like, I can't just move on. I have to address this. And that was what I went through last night. How do I do this perfectly? But that's the beautiful thing about the way I understand it, meditation and life itself. We don't have to do it perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to do it the best we can.
Mm-hmm.
And move on beyond that.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes I find that I am stuck in a situation and I can't move on. I just have to bear it and walk on ahead as best I can. So that too is, I think, very much just being in the center of the practice, to realize that at times life gets really tough, and generally for a relatively short period of time, the experience is really tough. I mean, things can last for a long time. The experience always is fluctuating. And so being willing to, I may not be able to move on, but I can be patient and life will move me on, because I will be in a different place within 2 hours or the next day.
Well, that's why a lot of people practice the where will you be, or how much will this matter in 5 years?
Yes, that's a good
that's a good practice to think. And I can tell you, I've had arguments with people. I've had some pretty serious disagreements, but I can't tell you what they were about. I never, ever remember why I was so angry, unless at some point there was some humor injected into the argument.
Wonderful.
And in fact, I'll talk about my Zen master, the cat, earlier. Yeah. My husband and I had a tumultuous point in our marriage where we thought we were going to split up. Mm-hmm. We were going through counseling. Counseling wasn't taking, it wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And so he just made the decision one day. He said, you know, I think it's just time. I'm going to go find myself an apartment. And so we started amicably discussing, okay, fine. We figured it was just broken. No need to put the glue on it and just throw it away and go away. So he started discussing, well, can I leave the car in the garage until I find a place? Sure, whatever, 6 weeks, whatever. Can I leave this? Yeah, I'll let you have it here for a month and then you've got to move on. And then he came to the cat. He said, well, which one of us is going to get custody of the cat? I said, are you going to find an apartment that lets you have pets? He says, probably not. I said, then why are you asking me this dumb question? You already know the answer. Don't ask me this question. Well, because of the way I snapped at him, he just laughed. And about that time, the cat came weaving its way between the two of us like cats do, as if to say, would you just shut up and get back together and get on? Where's my food dish? You know? And we laughed and then we cried and then we healed.
Yeah. Nice.
That's one of the reasons I call my cat my Zen master, because he seems to know exactly when we need him to remind us what's important and how to be more mindful of each other.
That's a wonderful quality of cats. I think cats are very aware and intuitive about the dynamics going on between people, and they will come and engage to sort of be a peaceful force in the interaction.
Absolutely. Question for our audience. How many little stories are in your book, Findings in the Ordinary?
Well, there's 48 different little vignettes or chapters. Some of them are actually stories, and some of them are dialogues, and some of them
You've got conversations with your...
Yeah, lots of different things. But there's 48 short elements there. I think the book is designed so people can read it pretty quickly or consume at different rates, or open it and put it down and take it up again.
Right.
So to be kind of engaged in that way.
I like that, because it reminds me of our little magazine, Be Unique. You don't want to sit down with a tome that's going to intimidate you. Mm-hmm. You grab it, read a page, flip more if you've got more time, or if you don't have time, just put it down, come back to it when it's convenient. And I think that it's important for people to understand that you can find Zen in the ordinary day-to-day part of life, walking out in your garden. And for me, it's when I look out at a vast patch of weeds and there's one flower.
Oh,
it's just sticking its head up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, it's not hopeless. I can weed around to that flower. And then I've got, it gives me a purpose.
Yeah.
If I walk out and the entire flower garden or vegetable garden is covered in weeds, it's like, just plow it under. Uh-huh. But if there's one flower or one vine, maybe a sweet potato vine might be growing, it gives me more of a, I don't know what the word is, but when you meditate, you sometimes focus on one object, and that gives me that object to focus on that makes the weeding less mundane or much less of a chore.
Well, it's that process of taking up each thing, also just the next thing, the next thing.
Right.
One of the things that seems to be very central in Zen is that is to draw us away from those kind of worries or the conceptual spinning out of sort of what does this all mean? In a sense, if you look out at a field that needs to get weeded, or a dirty kitchen that needs to have the dishes washed, or getting oneself out the door to work, that sense of just putting one foot forward.
Right.
Life is made up of just those little moments of putting oneself forward, presenting one's true self, to be there present with what's most needed now.
And I think sometimes we as humans want everything to be fun.
Mm.
And it can be.
Mm.
But there are, like you said earlier, there are moments that aren't always fun.
Mm-hmm.
but we can find a glimmer, a sparkle.
Right, right. In fact, that sparkle I find is something that's eternal. There's a characteristic in life that is the aspect we can't really name, but is I mean, I suppose you can call it God, or you can call it the higher self, or the broad sort of energy of the universe, or the present moment, kind of what arises right now. And it's in fact infused in everything we're doing. So there's remarkable beauty and wonder in just this moment of talking you with me, and the ideas that the people who are listening may have come through their minds. And that beauty and wonder is always there. It's there in every moment of our lives. And so it's, from my perspective, less about getting my life set up to have wonderful experiences or trying to avoid things that are things I don't like. And of course, I will navigate through my life to try to find the things that work well. But as much as anything, it's also being aware that if I live my life with purpose and with honesty, then I will also be living something that has inherent beauty and wonder to it. And if I'm aware of the inherent beauty and wonder of my life, it's a remarkable gift.
Yes, yes. And it's the silver lining in the cloud, or the rainbow after the rain. Mm. We know that it's always coming if we're just looking for it. It's not that hard to find. Mm-hmm. I think it goes back to the being mindful and being aware of where we are, and making the effort almost. Mm-hmm. Making the effort to not make an effort sometimes. Mm-hmm. That's what I have found. Sometimes I, because of my personality, I tend to be one of these driven people that wants to always go to the next thing. And that's, I keep going back to my cat, but it reminds me, you know, he comes and he'll just remind me sometimes, you need to get away from this computer. It's time for you to take care of me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And by doing that, I'm taking care of myself.
Yeah, that's nice. Very nice.
I think it's very important that people remember that you can't help someone else if you're not helping yourself first.
Mm-hmm. So I think we all spend a lot of time on computer these days too.
Oh, especially now.
Not all of us, but many of us, yes, are sitting on video and during this time of COVID. Yeah.
Yes, because we have to be careful. We have to be safe. And we've learned a lot of new ways to do the things that people used to do.
Yes, that's true.
But it's also opened up the world, because now Be Unique has always been globally minded.
Uh-huh.
So we've always talked to people from wherever, but I'm old enough to remember the radio shows where you had to go to the radio station if you were going to be interviewed. They might do it over the telephone.
Yeah.
But usually they'd say, well, can you come to Chicago on 14th? You know, those days are gone.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. It's,
and people who wrote
all
books
over the world. Yeah.
People who wrote books went on book tours.
Mm-hmm.
They would go either make an appearance on a radio show or a television show or do a book signing. We don't do it that way these days.
Yeah.
It's okay too. It's a lot of people worry that things won't be the way they used to be. Mm-hmm. And my thought is, why do we want them to be the way they used to be? The way they are now is working.
Yeah.
And it opened up the world for more people. In fact, your publisher has been phenomenal about getting us guests from all over the world.
That's so great. Yeah. The publisher is remarkable. It's John Hunt Publishing out of London. And they have a whole system that really interacts with people all over the world. And it's done mostly all through the internet and emails. And it's been a really remarkable system. So I speak highly of the publisher.
Now, that's where one place you can buy your book is through John Hunt Publishing, right?
That's correct. Yes.
Where else can people find your book?
It's available at Amazon and other places where you can get books, Borders, and it's in bookstores. And there's a website for the book at findingzenintheordinary.com. And you can find links there in order to purchase books. And it's listed, it can be sold by sellers in Australia and England and other English-speaking countries as well. And on the website, there's some of those listed too.
Okay, very good. We have about 10 minutes left in the show. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you want to make sure our listeners know about you or about your book or how they can find Zen in the Ordinary?
Well, I would say that Would you be okay if I read something from the book?
I'd love that.
All right. Well, this is the piece 29 called Who Saved Who. I took the spring semester off in my junior year of college, fully confused about my life's direction. I found myself back at my parents' house with no plans and nothing to do. My father, in his concern, found me a carpentry job with a middle-aged man named Jonas. Jonas had been out of work when a friend of my father hired him to repair a rundown colonial-era house. Jonas wasn't a carpenter by profession, but he was handy and had done repairs on his own home. I was also good with my hands, but uninitiated in carpentry. Jonas became my teacher. He showed me how to handle a cat's paw to remove nails, hold a plumb bob to find true vertical, and snap a chalk line to line things up. As we worked, we talked. Mostly, he talked, and I listened. Not only did I learn about carpentry, I learned about how he had lost his family inheritance by trying to build a new tennis center. I learned how he needed willpower to avoid ordering a drink when we went out for lunch together. I learned how he felt when his wife got upset after he left unwashed dishes in the sink. And I heard his heartache when he spoke about his eldest son, who was often racked by mental illness. Jonas honored me with his teaching and attention. He wished to be good to everyone and suffered from feelings of falling short. My time with Jonas changed me. His counsel and care helped me return to college the next semester and led me to work as a carpenter after college for 8 years. Decades later, I returned to attend Jonas's funeral. He had died of an aneurysm. At the service, his four children talked about their father and how he had told them stories about tunnels under the lawn that led to magical places. His eldest daughter spoke to me after the service. "You made a great difference to my dad," she said. "That was a difficult time in his life. The way you listened to him when you were working together turned his life around. He was able to get things back together."
That is a good story. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to read more stories like that, go buy Finding Zen in the Ordinary by Christopher Keevil. Thank you for joining us. I'm so delighted that I had this time with you.
You too, Mary. Yeah.
Thank you.
It's good to see your work and understand something of what you're doing. It's great.
Thank you. We are we're rabid about this publication and getting the word out and spreading more kindness and making the world a better place, one story at a time.
That's great. That's excellent.
That's how we find our Zen.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Through the stories. Yeah. Well, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you, Mary. I appreciate it. I appreciate having me on your show.
And good luck with your book sales.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
You're welcome.
Yes. Okay. And with your magazine and all.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you like the show tonight, let us know. Call 321-417-4309 or email mary@beunique.org to ask how you can sponsor the show. It's simple and doesn't have to cost much at all. Visit beunique.org for even more details. That's BUNEKE.org. Join the global world changers who already know how Be Unique helps bring together like-minded humans who are making the world a better place. Read the magazine and blog posts, watch our videos, listen to our podcast, and visit our social media from one location, and let's work together. Change tomorrow by finding solutions today. Visit BeUnique.org to learn more. That's BUNEKE.org.